What's up, guys? John the Morgow here. Gonna do a video on a, well, pretty old and well-known cliche, conundrum, enigma. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Although this is going to be the flat earth theoretical physics version of the same. Which came first, the gravity or the sphere? Or in Neil deGrasse Tyson's case, which came first, the gravity or the pear-shaped, apple-bottom, oblique spheroid.
What is gravity?
You have no idea. Okay, next question.
This is called gravity.
Neil, I gotta say, you're totally blowing my mind right now.
That's what I do. I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson. Bitch.
One of the oldest, most debated, simplistic, yet apparently profound philosophical conundrums of all time remains absolutely unanswered, baffling scientists, atheists, theologians, and impartial, normal people alike. The riddle at hand is, of course, the timeless, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Many will proclaim that the chicken obviously came from an egg, so the egg must have come first, right? It's a valid argument, it would seem, yet there are others who will logically proclaim, well, there must have been a chicken to lay that egg, so obviously the chicken came first. Now, technically, both sides of this argument are valid, however, neither can be correct. This is a microcosm of why life itself is incomprehensible, if not at least mysterious and contradictory in certain terms. This particular never-ending conundrum involving chickens and eggs has been satiated and patched over by the Darwinian theory of evolution, essentially passing the buck down the line, kicking the can down the line. With the theory of evolution, essentially claiming that the chicken's most ancient ancestor was a single-celled organism. When it comes right down to it, of course, the single-celled organism came from a pile of inanimate soup. Of course, there is no coherent explanation to describe how a mere amoeba came into existence. Such single-celled organisms reproduce or self-replicate by an asexual method process called binary fission. Now, after replicating its genetic material through mitotic division, the cell divides into two equally sized daughter cells. So we're still left with the problem that in order to have one single amoeba, you would first need to have an amoeba prior to that point to essentially divide into two different amoebas. So, you know, science truthfully has no answer to this question either. And with all our knowledge of DNA, which has really just barely even scratched the surface, our most ambitious, cutting-edge scientists cannot create a single seed or even a single-celled organism from scratch in the lab. So the rather simple conundrum involving chickens and eggs also appears to apply almost more complexly to the micro level, the most basic single-celled organisms. It seems perhaps even more perplexing than chickens and eggs. An amoeba that comes from themselves, another amoeba. So which came first, the amoeba or the amoeba? The idea that chickens have evolved from some sort of simplex, single-celled life doesn't really answer the question, as we don't have an explanation for the origins of the most simple forms of life. The worldwide primary world religion, scientism, proclaims that the conditions on planet Earth were conducive to forming life, for a number of really quite lucky reasons. Now, before I mention the reasons, please understand that I will be humoring the heliocentric theory in order to disprove the theory itself. So, for example, if I state planet Earth exists in the Goldilocks zone of the Sun, what I really mean to say is the hypothetically spherical Earth reportedly exists in the so-called Goldilocks zone of the theoretical host star, allegedly hosting the so-called solar system via the non-existing preposterous theorem of gravity and space-time, respectively. Now, I still will probably use some caveats, but to be clear, please consider this a blanket caveat to any heliocentric values presented, simply to save time. The intention is to disprove the conventionally accepted model of planet and star formation based upon the scientifically agreed upon process involved with the creation of the stars and planets. Now, the only reason I must make such a lengthy caveat statement is due to the fact that the trolls will try to take my words out of context to confuse people into thinking that I subscribe to certain heliocentric values, which is completely ridiculous and, of course, out of context. Now, the Copernican heliocentric globe Earth hypothesis is mutually exclusive to the flat Earth reality, so any examination of heliocentric values or assertions are to point out the blatant contradictions which lie therein. Now, I apologize for that excursion, but I really need to make myself clear sometimes on such things, as the trolls love to take our words out of context. So, according to scientism, planet Earth exists in the vacuum of space, orbiting the Sun at a distance which is perfect. Our orbital radius and velocity is moderate and perfect enough to support liquid water not too close to the Sun, where liquid water would instantly boil away, not too far from the Sun, where water remains permanently frozen, you know, in a frozen state. Equally important, of course, is the volume or the mass of the planet or Earth comes into play here theoretically as well, as the gravity of the planet needs to support sufficient barometric pressure to allow for liquid water as well, perfectly complementing the Goldilocks distance to the Sun, because again, too much barometric pressure and water will remain frozen. Not enough barometric pressure and water will boil. And so not only do you have this Goldilocks phenomenon, but you have to have a specific mass relative to that in order for the whole thing to work. So pretty, you know, lucky stuff going on here. Now, this brings up another giant elephant in the living room sort of contradiction in terms of the pressurized atmosphere of Earth existing allegedly adjacent to an infinite vacuum, which is purported in the preposterous heliocentric model. But that's straying from the topic at hand just a bit. If you'd like to see a video describing just how lucky and special planet Earth is, even according to the heliocentric model, really defying the Copernican principle with flying colors, check out the Globe is Dead section 4, and I'll put a card for that right here. Or you can check out the entire The Globe is Dead series playlist, and I'll put a card for that right here. So, the fact that we have countless coincidental conditions along with countless contradictions, which are perfect for sentient, self-replicating life on planet Earth, for example, you know, abundant liquid water, the proper chemical composition, tidal cycles, seasons, electromagnetic fields and the ionosphere filtering out harmful solar radiation and cosmic rays, and this symbiotic relationship between flora and fauna, which is, you know, yet another one of these conundrum, which came first, the plants or the animals, right? You also have things like volcanism, frequent lightning storms, etc., etc., all of these conditions that seem to be necessary to create the phenomenon of life on planet Earth, according to, you know, sort of a secular, scientismic view of things. Now, all of those conditions and many, many more are not guaranteed on a random planet, and it really appears that planet Earth, in a heliocentric theory is really quite lucky, to say the very least. Granting all of this, for argument's sake, chalking it up to multiple random coincidences, planet Earth is very much an extremely lucky, unique place to find yourself, even humoring this preposterous heliocentric or acentric slash galactic slash Copernican hypothesis universe theory. Now, back to the analogy involving chickens and eggs. Christians, atheists, Darwinists, scientists, and pretty much anyone even moderately interested in biology will assert that evolution allowed for chickens and eggs, parroting this narrative involving some prehistoric simplex organism, perhaps the great-great-great-grandson of a single-celled organism, must have laid something like a chicken egg, which hatched from something like an inferior chickenoid. Over millions of years, allegedly, of this Darwinian evolution, natural selection and long-term variations in gene expression, such once simplex organisms evolved into chickenoids. They must have become increasingly complex, to the point to where something slightly inferior to a chicken must have laid an actual chicken egg. Now, this sort of evolution would have perpetuated for millions of years, according to the mainstream scientific narrative, until mankind came along and halted the so-called evolutionary process of chickens by eliminating the possibility for natural selection to run its course, disallowing chickens to reach their full potential, severing their chance to become a superior form of chicken. In another few million years, if they were left to their own hypothetical evolutionary devices. Instead, we stacked them in cages, one on top of another, literally defecating all over one another in most cases, and that's what winds up on the dinner plate. So if you can try to get free roaming chickens, it's probably a good thing, just as I mentioned, if you're going to eat chickens. Anyway. Now, this whole halting of the chicken's evolutionary potential is a bit sad, although according to Lyons, chickens are the descendants of dinosaurs, so according to them, evolution involves increasing one's chances of success in survival and procreation by changing from a Tyrannosaurus rex or a pterodactyl into a literal effing chicken. Although that is completely irrelevant to the crux of this matter, I would submit that evolution is in serious question because sharks have remained sharks since the alleged age of the dinosaurs, although sharks have shrunken quite a bit. You know, you had these ginormous sharks allegedly way back then. Alligators and crocodiles have essentially remained the same for millions of years, according to scientists who've been studying alligators and crocodiles for exactly 0.0 million years, although they will have also shrunk in size in terms of the alligators and crocodiles, not the scientists. While there appears to be sufficient evidence supporting the existence of prehistoric creatures, the true existence of dinosaurs, as we're taught, is highly doubtful, as they appear to be a fabrication or sort of a collage narrative to support the evolutionary narrative as a whole, with really countless examples of artistic liberties superseding biological scientific data, obfuscating and glamorizing the idea of dinosaurs and evolution in the public conscious, clearly targeted at younger audiences, especially in the terms of dinosaurs, which is a pattern of the elite's mind control operation in terms of targeting children with their ideals and their narrative via the mainstream entertainment media directly. Now, again, the authenticity of dinosaurs, as well as things like the Peltdown Man, which were obvious hoaxes, coming up with entire species of alleged dinosaurs by mismatching different sorts of animal bones isn't exactly a science, especially when, the people who started finding dinosaur bones first had a theory of dinosaurs, started hunting for dinosaur bones, and lo and behold, they found dinosaur bones. And, they've been caught red-handed, mixing and matching bones, coming up with things that are just preposterous artists' renditions of some bones or fossilized bones. And the whole thing appears to be a hoax, but that's really a whole video in and of itself. But we do see, the idea of dinosaurs and evolution and globes targeted at younger audiences. And that's for a very specific reason, because, our minds and our worldviews or paradigms are molded very much so from cradle through toddlerism, through our teenage years. That's when we sort of form our worldview, and if they can manipulate that as early as possible, then they've really got us controlled by the short and curlies, as they say. Now, again, the authenticity of dinosaurs is neither here nor there in terms of the conundrum, as dinosaurs also laid eggs, allegedly. So you could say which came first, the dinosaur or the egg, but it's an interesting side note, as giant humans appear to have been prevalent throughout history worldwide, not just things of fairy tales. And this is apparently being subverted via a concerted cover-up by the Smithsonian, especially, as well as other such institutions who seem to be hiding the true origins of mankind from the general public. Now, dinos or no dinos, we still need to explain how self-replicating creatures formed from nothing. Now, members of the religion of Scientism believe that the inanimate chemical soup became simplex, single-celled organisms, which came before any chicken or any egg or theoretical dinosaur, of course, which is all well and good, theoretically, but their argument relies upon the random chemical creation of said complex organisms, which must have manifested into existence by some event that is still currently unknown to science. So the stalemate and mystery really still stands, even with the theory of evolution granted for argument's sake. Life forms are indeed comprised of quite simple inanimate materials such as water and carbon and other things, but a problem similar to the chicken and egg, or amoeba and amoeba, or dinosaur and egg in theory, another such problem indeed presents itself yet again. Now, how does inanimate primordial soup or primordial ooze become life, even simplex life? This is a mind-bender which will probably or absolutely never be definitively answered, although it's obviously an important question, because chickens are a well-known phenomenon, so they must have an origin, obviously. This means the conundrum described is something of a profound value, potentially, which should be deeply considered by everyone. But don't drive yourself crazy with it, because it will truly never be answered conclusively. Now, that's in contrast to the actual topic of this video. So, if you've watched this far, it's safe to say that we're all definitely on the same page in terms of the chicken and the egg conundrum. Of course, the biblical standpoint is that God created the chicken, and so the chicken came first, while the scientific secular community would say that it was a pile of inanimate soup which came first. However, neither will ever be proven definitively, scientifically, ever. Although one of them seems to make more sense than the other. And I'll let you be the judge of that, because that's really a matter of opinion or theology. Now, separate from evolution, gene expression is a known biological factor where the same types of animals will flourish in varying climates or varying environments, which produces different variations of the same animal type through gene expression, although these different flavors of creatures will still be able to mate with one another. So, for example, a Doberman Pinscher can mate with a Chihuahua, which are two seemingly completely different creatures, but they're both dogs, and so they can mate with one another, and you'll probably get a very strange sort of little dog, but a dog nonetheless. Perhaps a mini Doberman Pinscher, which are particularly cute and adorable. But the point is, all such creatures will still be dogs, regardless of the varying gene expressions or manipulations, you know, be it due to environmental variables or controlled breeding practices or some other means of control or influence over the offspring. The point is, the astronomical heliocentric version of the chicken and the egg riddle, which I hope to coherently convey in a similar fashion as previously, that differs from the actual chicken and egg analogy, specifically because the process and end result involving chickens are sensible, obvious, and demonstrable. So, you know, we can watch a chicken hatch, we can watch it grow, we can watch it lay an egg, and we can watch it hatch. So there's a cycle there that we can definitely confirm and verify. So that's a sensible, obvious, repeatable, demonstrable thing. On the other hand, the process and end result of a planets and stars being formed is not such a demonstrable and verifiable thing. So yes, you just heard about chicken procreation and the formation of celestial bodies in the same sentence, but let me explain. The riddle involving star formation is really quite similar to the chicken and egg enigma, but is far beyond the realm of sensibility. It's really downright laughable, to be honest. Similarly, the mysterious explanation of planet formation is equally as absurd and illogical as the stars, if not more so than the narrative of newborn stars. In brief summary, the bewildering puzzle here is, which came first, the gravity or the sphere? So, in terms of star and planet formation, analogous to the chicken and the egg conundrum, according to the heliocentric Copernican theory of the universe, stars and planets are created by the whimsical, elusive force of gravity, creating perfect spherical order out of chaotic, amorphous clouds of gases, which somehow exist in an infinite vacuum. Beginning with the stars, it is claimed that vast clouds of gases called nebulae or nebula exist in the far reaches of outer space. Now, these nebulae are allegedly comprised of dust, hydrogen, helium, and other various ionized gases, which slowly form stars within these enormous, curious space clouds. Now, once formed, the stars are somehow jettisoned off into space to form their own high-velocity solar systems, and eventually meet up with other stars to form galaxies around the theoretical supermassive black holes central to theoretical galaxies. Right, so right off the bat, this sounds like a fairy tale, as nebulae, you know, giant amorphous clouds of gas, simply cannot exist in the theoretical infinite vacuum of space. So either gravity will supposedly cause large amounts of dust and gas to naturally sort of coalesce and form into a sphere, or the vacuum of space will not allow for amorphous clouds to exist within such a, you know, low or negative pressure environment. Science claims that gravity is such a weak force, it can only be generated in sufficient measures by really extremely massive objects. Now, oddly, the star-forming nebulae are comprised of very tiny particles and gases spread out over unimaginably vast areas, and they don't form any sort of sphere whatsoever. Such, you know, amorphous clouds of gases would certainly not be conducive to gravity, nor would they be conducive to remaining intact as clouds within a great vacuum, since gravity can only be generated by massive, dense objects in space, and clouds of gas cannot exist in a vacuum. So, really, which came first, the gravity or the star? Either the gases within the star forming the nebulae are large conglomerations of matter, massive and dense enough to create a gravity well in the theory of space-time within the nebulae, or the amorphous nebulae would simply dissipate or evaporate, expanding into infinity due to the lack of physical form, density, and gravity to keep it intact within a near-perfect theoretical vacuum. Terms of the nebula. So really, which came first, the gravity or the large conglomeration of spherical matter necessary to create the gravity which eventually forms the star? You simply can't have one without the other. You can't have it both ways. You can't have your gravitational cake and eat your gravitational cake too. As you need gravity to create massive spheroids, yet you need massive spheroids to create or generate gravity, and I certainly wouldn't consider disparate gases high-density spheroids. All of this rendering the entire theoretical process of star and planet formation as completely nonsensical hogwash, violating the very basic laws of physics, theoretical or demonstrable, for example, gravity or fluid dynamics, respectively. You know, the theories of gravity are violated, and the facts of fluid dynamics are violated by the theoretical process of star and planet formation, quite frankly. Now, by some miracle of science, we have these nebulae which are somehow immune to the laws of fluid dynamics, existing in a cloud-like state amidst an infinite vacuum. Now, the molecules of gases and dust comprising such nebula would not possess enough gravité to stick together, so they should technically expand infinitely, eventually populating the void of space evenly, given enough time, theoretically. It is argued that the gases comprising such star-forming nebulae are supercooled, frozen at the molecular level, approaching the theoretical temperature of absolute zero. Now, they claim such molecules are in a sort of unique state of quasi-solidarity, although that really inherently disagrees with the claim that star-birthing nebulae are amorphous clouds of gases. You know, either a collection of gases are an amorphous cloud, or they're a frozen clump of solid-state matter. You just simply can't have it both ways, especially within a vacuum. Yet, that's exactly what Lyons tries to proclaim regarding the theory of nebulae birthing stars. Now, granting the idea of star-birthing nebula for argument's sake, which is truly a contradiction in and of itself, we then must consider the process of such stars being born out of the massive clouds of gas in the vacuum of space. We then must consider the process of such stars after they're born out of the massive clouds of gas, theoretically, in the vacuum of space. Now, it's claimed that the higher density areas of dust and gases will begin attracting more and more stuff towards itself via gravity. And after millions of years, the amount of pressure and matter built up in one area becomes so great that the star is formed, somehow jump-starting or kick-starting the theoretical, whimsical act of hypothetical hot atomic fusion, which is really merely theoretical and cannot be replicated or demonstrated. Even if such a thing could be demonstrated, hot atomic fusion could in no way be associated to such a process as the inner workings of a star, but that's irrelevant to the point here. Holding that thought for a moment, if a star is formed in a nebula, shouldn't that star begin to suck up all of the surrounding gases and dust around it exponentially? as the more mass the star gains, the more gravity is produced. And the more gravity is produced, the more mass the star would have, and so on and so forth. It would be a never-ending exponential growth, eventually snowballing into a superstar. And in fact, you could say that a snowball would have a better chance in hell than a nebula with a star within its midst. Pun totally intended. Logically, such a process would inevitably deplete the entire nebula of most of its gases via the star's immense, exponentially growing gravitational field. And of course, the nebula's inability to resist such an immensely attractive force within the very center of the cloud itself is just as perplexing as the nebula's ability to hold form in the vacuum of space, theoretically. Really, how could such gases exist within a vacuum, enveloping an object as gravitationally rich as a superstar? This is a double contradiction, as a body of gas couldn't possibly exist in a vacuum without expanding to infinity, nor could it remain separate from the gravitational pull of a star within the giant imaginary cloud of dust and gas. Now, for argument's sake, we'll even hand them the preposterous idea of nebula and the absurd theoretical process of star formation. Yet, we still have the problem of a star's velocity as it exits its birthing nebula. Now, how could a star, which was part of a stationary cloud relative to the star itself, how could that star somehow accelerate out and away from its birthing nebula at literally hundreds of thousands of miles an hour? It seems that if gravity were the only force involved with star creation inside of such a nebula, the star itself would behave as an omnidirectional inward attractor, growing larger and larger until all those gases in the nebula itself were a part of the star, at which point it would be stationary, you know, at least according to the frame of reference attributed to the nebula. Now, according to the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, volume 30, page 89, this is a quote: "The Sun and a specific nebula as a whole are moving away from each other with a velocity of about 18 kilometers per second, but by far the greater part of this relative velocity is due to the Sun's own alleged motion through space, and only a small fraction due to the actual motion of the nebula. In fact, this nebula, like other diffuse gaseous nebulae, seems to be almost stationary when compared to the motion of the average star," end quote. So, if the nebula are, quote, almost stationary, end quote, according to the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, what exactly causes the stars birthed by such nebula to autonomously cease sucking up the dust and gases of its mother nebula via gravity, subsequently accelerating to mind-boggling velocities in some direction away from the nebula, which is almost stationary? In the quote above, they mentioned the velocity of the Sun relative to some nebula as being about 18 kilometers per second, which is actually far slower than the Earth's alleged speed around the Sun, by the way. Now, this seems to be an extremely low velocity when you consider the alleged velocity of the Milky Way galaxy itself, which is claimed to be in the millions of miles per hour, and the Sun's velocity, which is claimed to be about a half a million miles an hour. So I'm not sure how the Sun could be moving away from any nebula at 18 kilometers per second. But in any case, what exactly causes a star to accelerate away from the cloud of dust and ionized gases which originally birthed the star to begin with? These sort of issues seem to be really major holes and problems with the theoretical astrophysics description of star and planet formation. lucky for them, their allegations remain in the realm of non-testable pseudoscience, at least in physical terms, so they have pretty much carte blanche to fabricate every last bit of their theoretical assertions without any chance of being physically disproved, not even in a million years. Of course, we are right in the middle of theoretically disproving the premises involved with the theory of Copernican gravitational creation of stars and planets, and by now, the reason why I believe such things are so preposterous should be obvious to you if you've stuck around this far, and thanks for sticking around. Now, to take this absurd roller coaster even further, we'll also go ahead and hand them the stars somehow forming within, then accelerating away from their birthing nebulae without any explanation for either, from the nebulae, which technically shouldn't exist in a vacuum, described as being essentially stationary, no less. The star then setting off on a course through outer space, when the star should technically maintain the velocity of its host nebula, unless some outside force comes along to compel the star on another trajectory. And according to gravity, the star should continue gathering up the dust and gases of the host nebulae until every last molecule either assimilates into the star or expands out into the infinite space. Now, we sure are handing a lot over, for argument's sake, to the heliocentric psychotic retards to the point of idiocy, passing out theoretical impossibility after theoretical impossibility as freebies just for argument's sake. But with all of that preposterous theory granted, as the star somehow accelerates and travels away from its birthing dust cloud that shouldn't exist, it carries with it some of the gases and particulates from the nebula through the vacuum of space. Such behavior is exactly impossible, according to the Copernican/Gravitic universe theory, as the star may be gravitationally rich enough to maintain its solid spherical form as it ventures off into space in response to some unknown force away from its birthing nebula. However, the dust surrounding the star should either be pulled into the star by gravity or evaporate to fill the infinite void of space, technically speaking. Of course, neither of these things occur, theoretically, and what happens instead is probably the most ridiculous portion of this nonsensical tale of secular creation insofar. Now, the dust and gases around the newborn star somehow form a perfect equatorial ring, describing a single equatorial plane around the star, akin to the rings of Saturn or to the Sun's ecliptic plane. Such a ring of disparate gases maintaining a singular plane of orbit as the star travels at hundreds of thousands of miles per hour through the infinite vacuum of space is yet another physical impossibility for a variety of reasons which have already been described in excruciating detail in other contexts. So, what exactly is causing the dust and the gas to form a consistent equatorial plane unaffected by the star's velocity or trajectory, describing essentially a ring around the star, similar to our ecliptic plane, theoretically, or again, the rings of Saturn. A high-velocity, enormous object rich in gravity, such as the star, could conceivably leave a trail of dust and gas behind it. However, it should technically be sucking up and assimilating any dust and gas in front of its trajectory, but the idea of a ring of gas maintaining a perfect plane of orbit around such a massive high-velocity star is physically impossible, even humoring the heliocentric theory. In summary, the star only exists in the vacuum of space due to its tremendous gravity. However, the gases allegedly surrounding it would simply not persist in a vacuum. Such a thing is impossible. So, let's be honest with ourselves. we are considering the scientifically accepted explanation for creation of stars and planets, yet the obvious physical and theoretical impossibilities involved are so overwhelming, it's really rather irrelevant to continue along this line of thought. Even if you still believe the Earth is a spinning sphere in outer space, certainly you can't adhere to the hypothetical origins of the spinning sphere Earth. This should be extremely thought-provoking to anyone who adheres to Big Bangism or heliocentrism, as the heliocentric model depends on such cockamamie, physically impossible theoretical origins of stars and planets in order to work. Now, this hypothetical plane of gases surrounding the sun as it passes through space are allegedly what formed into the planets over many millions of years. Now, one big problem here is the very definition of gravity. Even humoring the Einsteinian warping of space-time theory, for argument's sake, in order to create gravity, the Earth must be a sphere in space. A sphere must have curvature, and unfortunately the Earth doesn't have any consistent inverse square curvature anywhere, as we've proven by countless practical experiments for the last 2 years. Without Earth curvature, there simply can be no space-time curvature, even if such a thing as space-time existed, which it couldn't possibly exist anyway. Theoretical gravity relies upon extremely dense, massive objects to generate gravitational fields, bending the natural rectilinear nature of space-time, comprised of exactly a vacuum, aka nothing. This means the gases which allegedly coalesced to form the Earth some millions of years ago were adherent to a consistent plane of orbit around the Sun in a gaseous form, now more or less 93 million miles in radius around the Sun, according to the theory. So, such disparate gases would not have been massive or dense enough to reciprocate the Sun's gravity, as the Earth does, allegedly, as such gases would have been spread out over quadrillions of square miles, certainly not compressed into the high-density spheroid that we have now, allegedly. Such theoretical gases prior to Earth around the Sun in a vacuum should have, again, technically evaporated into space immediately after the Sun left its birthing nebula, or, on the other hand, they could have also been added or assimilated into the Sun's mass by the overwhelming attraction of solar gravity. Now, that same gas couldn't possibly exist in the vacuum of space, describing a perfect ecliptic plane around the Sun under any circumstances. The massive, dense, spherical Earth is allegedly orbiting the Sun, describing a 93 million mile radius ellipse around a consistent singular plane relative to the Sun, of course, aka the ecliptic plane, which is only possible due to Earth's alleged gravité complementing or reciprocating the Sun's alleged gravity. So, the gases which allegedly existed in a 93 million mile radius plane, plus or minus, around the Sun prior to Earth's formation couldn't possibly have been orbiting the Sun due to the myriad laws of physics already described several times in excruciating detail in other contexts insofar. Again, these would be fluid dynamics not allowing for clouds or disparate gases to exist in a vacuum environment, and of course gravité not behaving as a structural barrier between a vacuum and a pressurized environment. And, of course, supermassive objects have the exclusive ability to reciprocate the Sun's gravitational field from such great distances as 93 million miles away. And, of course, the rings of gases around a large, highly gravitic body in hypersonic motion through a vacuum are a theoretical fantasy, which, while comical and illogical, are a necessary component and a phantom of the heliocentric theory in terms of star formation and planet formation. Both of these theoretical processes defy fundamental laws of physics. Even humoring the preposterous. So, as these disparate gases coalesce into planets, we've handed theoretical physics so many gimmies, their theory is shown to be the definition of preposterous, in fact, as all the fundamental premises needed to make their ideas work are physical impossibilities. The end result of any practical experiment is always measurably a flat and stationary world, rendering the necessity for such absurd and hyperbolic theory involving the formation of stars and planets as impossible, unnecessary, and irrelevant to reality. To put this argument in another frame, consider the cosmic interloper Halley's Comet, which passes through our inner solar system once every 75 years. Now, Halley's Comet is supposedly low mass, low density, and low velocity relative to the planets. It is somehow compelled to orbit the Sun in such a wild, illogical manner, according to the heliocentric theory and laws of gravity. For an in-depth look at the problems with Halley's Comet, check out my recent documentary, Flat Earth, Halley's Comet documentary. I'll put a card right here. And a quick summary of the major problem involved with Halley's Comet is the fact that the relatively puny, low-density object nearly reaches the orbital distance of the planetoid Pluto during Halley's aphelion. While Pluto may be small relative to the other so-called planets, it really is unimaginably massive and dense by human standards, or compared to a comet even such as Halley's Comet. Now, according to the heliocentric hypothesis, Pluto orbits the Sun at a distance of about 3.67 billion miles. Pluto is claimed to be about 1.5 billion cubic miles in volume, with a density of about 1.9 grams per cubic centimeter, traveling at a velocity of 10,600 miles an hour around the Sun. Comparatively, Halley's Comet is allegedly about 167 cubic miles, which is less than 1% of Pluto's alleged volume. Halley's Comet is estimated to be plus or minus 1 gram per cubic centimeter in density, reaching as far out into space as about 3.3 billion miles from the Sun, traveling at a velocity of about 144,000 miles per hour maximum at the point when it's just coming around the Sun in its alleged perihelion, a mere 56 million miles from the Sun at that point. Again, it ranges from 56 million miles from the Sun at its closest to 3.3 billion miles at its furthest, which is really quite close, 90% of the distance to the alleged orbital distance of the planetoid Pluto, which is the far reaches of the outer solar system in theory, of course. So, such mathematical extrapolations described just now are accepted science, yet the data debunks itself in a very similar manner to the alleged process involved with star and planet formation. The point is, a puny, low-density, high-velocity object such as Halley's Comet couldn't possibly reciprocate the gravitational pull of the Sun at a distance approaching that of Pluto's alleged orbital radius. According to the heliocentric theory, the only possible means for a planetoid such as Pluto to maintain its orbital relationship with the Sun is its sheer mass, density and volume. While relatively smaller than the other so-called planets, Pluto is supposedly billions of times larger and perhaps twice as dense as Halley's Comet. that allows for Pluto to maintain a gravitationally bound orbit around the Sun in theory. So it is the mass of that object that allows for the orbit. Now, Halley's Comet, on the other hand, is a horse of a different color, as it were. Once this puny, low-density, really high-velocity object reaches its aphelion, or its most distant point in its orbit, some 3.3 billion miles away from the Sun, it simply wouldn't have the mass necessary to reciprocate the gravitational pull of the Sun, needed to reverse its trajectory back towards the Sun. And even if such a turnaround in space were possible, which it isn't, but even if it were, it should be headed directly towards the center of the Sun, right? It should be headed out in a trajectory around the front of the Sun. That's ridiculous. Such maneuvers are preposterous and impossible, according to the heliocentric model, which is about as absurd as anyone can imagine. I mean, if you really believe you live stuck to the side of a spinning sphere in a vacuum, you want to call me crazy, then debunk this evidence and tell me how your imaginary planets are formed. Again, according to the theory, the distant planetoid Pluto is only sticking around due to its high-density, high-volume composition. Anything less would result in an impossible orbital pattern, rendering the phenomenon of Halley's Comet an excellent disproof, disagreeing with the heliocentric model and the theory of gravity. A cosmic interloper, which only graces the world every 75 years, coming dangerously close to the Sun during its perihelion, without ever actually crashing into the Sun magically, approaching the orbital distances ascribed to Pluto in its aphelion, are just a huge monkey wrench in the mechanisms of the heliocentric gravitic premise as a whole. Anyone who denies this particular fact, or these sets of facts that have been described from star formation to planet formation in its sort of a different light in the existence of Halley's Comet and its alleged orbital path, as well as the chicken and the egg, by the way, anyone who denies, you know, these facts has either not thought these things through properly, or they fail to understand them, or they're outright lying. Logic prevails over insanity in all cases, and the hypothetical orbital path of Halley's Comet is just another piece to this puzzle, which is completed by the total realization of a flat and stationary Earth without motion, without orbit, without curvature, without axial rotation, flat and stationary, flatter than a pancake, never moved a single yard, answers all these questions perfectly, and the celestial lights are a mystery. They are not anything like unto the Earth. While the age-old question involving chickens and eggs remains unanswered, the heliocentric theory remains in checkmate, spilling over with obvious contradictions galore, akin to the whimsical creation of stars and planets and many other things. Under close inspection, the scientific nonsense utilized to mathematically describe the origins of the very ground beneath our feet is obvious fiction. We've been led to believe a worthless, withering facade of lies presented to us as settled science since we were gullible toddlers, according to the most brilliant minds of all time, so who are we to argue? The mere fact that science cannot adequately prove which came first, the chicken or the egg, should tell us a little bit about science. The fact that the same obviously retarded scientists claim to know how stars and planets are formed should cast that fact about the chicken and the egg in a completely different light, especially in respect to the facts presented within this video, showing science to be an arrogant endeavor of philosophically biased men as opposed to a respectable, honorable stride towards truth. finally, the ultimate cosmological conundrum, which came first, the gravity or the sphere, has now been definitely answered. Quite simply, there is no sphere. However, we've established there's much more bullshittery afoot here than just the sphere. Specifically, if such a spherical Earth actually existed, the sphere and gravity would necessarily be symbiotic, interdependent, and inseparable. Gravity simply cannot exist without a massive spherical object to warp the theoretical vacuum of space-time. However, the massive spherical object cannot exist without the gravity. So you really can't have one without the other, and you have to have both to have both. Right? It's like peanut butter and jelly. Only, yeah, not really. So to say that a planar ring of dust and gas surrounding the sun after its physically impossible birthing nebula coalesced it into the spherical Earth due to the theory of gravity is logically fallacious on so many levels, it's repulsive. And it took about an hour to describe the logical fallacies comprising our planet formation completely and conclusively, along with star formation and a couple other things. Now, it was well worth the effort on my end, and if you, the viewer, better understand how preposterous the religion of scientism and hypothetical astrophysics truly are, then great, mission accomplished. Now, nobody really knows what the sun is or how it was formed. However, we can categorically proclaim that amorphous nebulae in the theoretical vacuum of space-time couldn't possibly be the origins of our world. For ample logical contradictions in the theoretical process of formation itself, beginning with the existence of large amorphous clouds of dust and gases in the infinite vacuum of the theory of space-time, governed by gravity, chaos, lady luck, which has apparently graced the insignificant planet Earth in so many instances, it is staggering. So with that, I'm going to wrap this up right now. So that was sort of an excerpt from the book. If you've been following along, it's coming along great. This was somewhere that was about 4 pages or so in the 56s range. But it's a topic that I did want to get out there because wanted to run this by my subscribers and viewers to see what you guys think. Give it a thumbs up if you liked it. If you'd like to support the channel or the book effort, you can do so to this direct link here. It's paypal.me/themorgal1 or direct through PayPal to jonelance@gmail.com. YouTube advertisers are pulling out, or so it appears, and so relying on the community for support. You guys have been really, really great to help out. Don't forget to tune into Globusters Live every Sunday at 3 o'clock p.m. And with that, God bless you all. Thanks for hanging out. Spread the word, spread the world, and peace.